Welcome back to episode 3 of the Defendo cast. I am Lisa Schmeiser, as usual, and with me are Tony Sindelar, and we are excited and pleased to include Nathan Alderman on tonight's lineup as well.
Hello.
Also, hello.
Also, hello. Hello to all of our nerd friends.
Yes.
Phil Mosalak will be back at his earliest convenience and or when he promises to stop smack-talking Jessica Jones to me in the incomparable Slack. I find that unacceptable. Anyway, we are here to talk about episode 2 of The Defenders tonight. People who listened to the Flash cast and or the first two episodes of the Defendo cast are slightly familiar with our podcast format. One of us will have volunteered to recap this episode in 1 minute or less. And what we'll do after that is talk about the things we like the most, talk about some of the questions we have, talk about some of the things we've noticed, and take a look at how this series is a capstone to some of the other Marvel series, what it's picking up, what it's ignoring, and where it's pushing everything forward. All right, with all the procedural out of the way, let's get started on our recap. We did not draw numbers or use a random internet number generator. I am hoping that either Nathan or Tony.
I'll be happy to.
All right, thank you.
Nathan, I'm willing to go if you want to save your efforts for later. I was like, you're a guest here, right? Like we don't
make the guests do the dishes.
I'm not very prepared either. So, you know.
Yeah. Just one of you needs to scream my volunteer is tribute. We can get this thing started.
Throw me in that battle arena.
There we go. Okay.
See, we put you to work.
All right. So Nathan, let me know when you want me to count you down so that this way you don't have to keep an eye on the time and we'll do that for you. All right.
Okay. Go for it.
All right. Ready? 5, 4, 3, 2, go.
Matt Murdock continues to wrestle with his Catholic guilt. He is damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. He continues to need to go out into the night and hit people, but he also wants to be a good boy and follow the law and maybe get back in the good graces of Karen Page. He meets up with Foggy Nelson, who hands him some pro bono work that will be important later in hopes that that will curtail Matt's night job. Jessica Jones continues to investigate the mysterious explosives and the missing architect. She meets the man's family, meets Misty Knight, who immediately takes a disliking to her and later will look very annoyed when she finds Jess covered with blood. Jess finds she's a little too good at her job. She finds mysterious clues suggesting that the company the architect was working with dates back to the 1800s, and later finds the architect himself in her office, who says some cryptic stuff, threatens Malcolm with a gun, and then gets ninja'd to death before he blows his own head off and introduces Elektra to Jess. Elektra runs away. Jess runs into Misty. Luke is still hunting for source of the criminals who are leading kids in Harlem to a bad end. He finds his friend Cole doing mysterious cleanup at a crime scene where intrepid ninja detective Colleen Wing and her bumbling sidekick Danny Rand have also come, sparking a fight between Danny and Luke. So those two cross paths, and the episode ends with Jess in police custody meeting her new lawyer Matt Murdock, who has picked up her case from the stack of pro bono stuff that Foggy gave him. Also, Sigourney Weaver slinks around looking fabulous and saying cryptic things that suggest she's a lot older than she looks.
So I'm taking off 2 seconds because I laughed twice, and you clocked in at 1 minute and 42 seconds, which for somebody who has never been forced to do a flash recap before is impressive.
Also very thorough.
Yeah, you hit every
major. What I need is one of you in my earpiece saying, "Talk, Nathan, talk." That'll make me go faster. That's
all. Think about your feelings, and I guess I'm not very good at the flash pep speak. So,
don't look at the weird thing running next to you. That'll just weird you out. No. Nathan, the great thing about your recap is you hit on several key things to talk about. Do we want to start with the internal struggle that Matt Murdock is going through? Would we like to talk about Alexandra and how much she does or does not intrigue us? Would we like to talk about Colleen Wing and her dimwit boy sidekick? Would we enjoy talking about Jessica Jones? Those seem to be like our four main beats. Luke Cage is kind of this heartbeat of decency through this episode, but it doesn't really showcase him the same way that the other three do. And yeah, I think it's a pretty deliberate choice on the parts of the writers, but for the sake of this podcast, we don't need to talk about him quite as much as we do the other three.
I do want to say two quick things about Luke. Mm-hmm. One, I like that he's basically Black Captain America.
Yes.
That he, like Cap, he has this core of decency. He's earnest, morally unbending. He's a little bit square, and he's totally endearing and a total sweetheart when he gets flustered, which he can be easily flustered by a beautiful woman who likes him. And I love that about Luke, and I love the way they position him as kind of the Captain America of the group. Mm-hmm. And I also love that. So later on in the series, Luke will learn that bad things have befallen his friend Cole, who he was trying to help when he's mm-hmm. with Cole's mother. And unlike any of the other characters in the series, Luke, if you watch his reaction, Luke's not surprised.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing about Luke relative to all the other characters. Luke very deliberately is positioned as someone who comes from a world in which the wolf is always at the door, mm-hmm. in which this kind of tragedy, people getting eaten up in the gears of the system, isn't just a tragedy. It's pretty much an inevitability. So whereas Jessica might shrug and get drunk, or Matt might feel guilty, Luke just bears the weight because he has to, because, you know, he knows, unlike any of the other characters, that this is what happens in his world.
And that life is unfair. Yeah,
exactly. I love that about the character, and I love that the series takes time to emphasize that.
So we're not spoiling the series here. We are actually spoiling the podcast when we reveal that Nathan is going to be on the next episode, where we talk about episode 3. And what I want to do is get back to that conversation with you about Luke in the next episode, because I think, when we get to talking about that episode, what we can do then is talk about the background that Luke has relative to the other three characters, and how it's positioned him to see the world in profoundly different ways than they do, and why that's so important for the Defenders.
Why did you spoil me? I wanted I didn't know that I was going to be on the next episode.
Now you know.
Surprise, you're on the next episode. Yay!
Man, I hate spoilers. The whole third episode is going to be ruined for me now, knowing that I'm going to be on it.
Erica ends and angrily, like, throws down her iPod and screams, "No spoilers!" I'm intimidated by her and her spoiler policy, by the way. Having felled over Luke Cage, and by the way, he and Danny have a fantastic fight at the end of this episode, and the reason it's fantastic is because it is pretty much between the immovable object of Luke Cage and the irresistible, in the purely physics sense, the irresistible force that is Danny Rand's Iron Fist. And watching how they go into the fight and why they have the fight, it's believable by both sides, even if you're like, "Oh, Danny, you idiot." It's believable why he'd fight. It's equally believable why Luke fights. And it's kind of fun to watch, because you're like, "Ooh, how is this going to shake out? How long until the fist comes out? What happens when the fist comes out?" And we find out. So that's pretty cool and pretty fun. But
So in between our last episode and this episode, I've now consumed all of Iron Fist. So So that's
you
me
are
now.
A braver man than I.
I'm a different person. I hope that I'll be better prepared for something, but I don't know what that thing is yet. but to be determined. I think the fight scenes with Danny Rand in The Defenders are better than most of the fight scenes with Danny Rand anywhere in all of Iron Fist. So.
Ben Jones had more time to practice and to actually learn how to do Kung Fu, which is sort of the important thing that you want from the lead of your Kung Fu series.
Yeah, yeah. It's not great.
The Drunken Master fight is the highlight of Iron Fist, and what's really unfortunate is it's the highlight precise because the guy Danny is fighting is so good and so charismatic. You're like, I want to see more of that.
Yeah.
So
it's hard.
I remember of Iron Fist is whenever any other character is on screen relative to Danny Rand, you're like, I want to see more of that person rather than Danny Rand.
Yeah.
It's hard. While watching Iron Fist, because I was watching it kind of like, I need to get through this, and I was watching it like an episode or two every night for multiple nights in a row. And in the middle, I watched the latest XXX movie, which is a horrible movie, but it's amazing, and it has Danny Yen and Tony Jaa in it, who are both amazing martial artists. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is what martial arts is supposed to look like on movies. These guys are great. Why isn't one of them Iron Fist? And
it's like
probably
extremely
they can do
deadly
better projects.
Yeah. It's like Extremely Deadly Dancing, and that when it's done well. And I think we've talked about this on previous podcasts. I still contend that part of the problem is that the writer's room has not done a good job of really thinking through Danny Rand as a character. And my sense is that Finn Jones is playing what was given to him on the page, and what was given to him on the page is just not that great. So that's
one of the reasons I love the Defenders. They take the weaknesses in Iron Fist and they turn them, if not into strengths, then into assets for the overall series and the team dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that does come up. It begins to come up here. I still feel like episode two is a Matt and Jessica episode, even though their paths don't cross until literally the last 5 seconds, when one of the best closings of a Marvel TV episode comes on. But what I really enjoy about this episode is that you see Jessica work, and you see how dogged she is when she is in the documents archive, and she just keeps going and keeps digging and keeps going and keeps digging. And you can tell she's getting both frustrated and confused, but it's like her curiosity has such a grip on her that she's like, I can manage my feelings by ignoring them right now. I will take them out inappropriately later. I need to figure out what's going on with these companies. And I loved that sequence because it's one of the few where you see Jessica and she's not drunk. She's not emotional. She's not hitting something. She's not grappling with her demons. She's putting her mind to work. And I like it a lot because it also just suggests who she could have been if she had not spent, you know, an entire series dealing with a brain hijacking psychopath.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. It's what John Rogers, the showrunner of Leverage, called competence porn. Watching people be good at their jobs is deeply satisfying, especially if those people are terrible at everything else. Mm-hmm. The McNulty principle, if you will.
Oh, God. So what Nathan's just for those of you who may or may not know, McNulty, as played by Dominic West, was a cop on the wire whose pre-epic misadventures punctuated occasional bouts of good detectiving. And I mean, it's just, he was such a frustrating character, but anyway, the McNulty principle's at work here. And what I also really enjoy is that Alexandra's initials never change.
I mean, you're going to change the monograms on your towels every 100 years? That's just too much of an inconvenience.
Too wasteful. I'm
only as far along in Defenders as we are in podcasting it. I'm really waiting on you guys for when we podcast, so I have not seen the end yet. I am intrigued by Alexandra. I mean, Sigourney Weaver is a pretty great actress, so I'm interested to see where that goes. I feel like they're laying it on a little thick with the I'm very old. I'm reminded almost of like a pretentious vampire who has to remind you that they've been around for forever.
See, I don't know. I thought her reference to Bach and Brahms was actually a nicely subtle way to hint, she's been around a lot longer than we think.
I was just like, I just come on, Madame Gao has heard this before. Madame Gao is like rolling her eyes, but she has the same face in front of Alexandra. Yeah, I don't know. For me, that was a little too much.
Madame Gao is the best. And yes. I love that Alexandra is watching a string quartet, one of whom is a woman.
Nice parallel. Can we talk a bit about Alexandra and Madame Gao for a minute? Because what I find really interesting is the way they're dressed, respectively. Because you look at Madame Gao, and she's wearing a dress that honestly looks like she just shortened it from, you know, like she's had that thing since 1850 when she was running an opium den in San Francisco. And then, like, she looked around at some point during the 1930s and went, I should raise the hemline. And that was it. Like, that is how she's dressed. And I find it interesting that she's always in shades of gray. Mm-hmm. Whereas you look at Alexandra and she's almost always in cream or white with gold accents or a black accent of some sort. But her presentation is very, very different and very drapey. And I'm like, is that meant to reference Alexandria? Are we supposed to infer that she's actually old enough to have, you know, helped with the fall of Rome? But I wanted to call attention to the wardrobe choices here because they seem incredibly deliberate, and Madame Gao's kind of carefully gray shabbiness is such an incredible contrast. I was wondering if anybody else had noticed that as well, or what your thoughts on it were.
I love that Madame Gao basically dresses like, one, she doesn't give a care, and two, you're not supposed to notice her, which makes sense. And Alexandra, it's an interesting contrast because Alexandra very much dresses to be noticed. She's the rich and powerful one. She's the famous one. Madame Gao is the one skulking around back alleys and the back rooms of sweatshops. Yeah. And I like that. I like that about Madame Gao. She's a, for a villain, she's a tremendously likable character because she's so unassuming and no nonsense.
Yeah. I feel like Alexandra fits a little bit more into your kind of classic supervillain kind of look. And Madame Gao is, I am a classic supervillain, but I'm going to disappear in a crowd, right? Like, you are never going to know who I was.
Which honestly seems like a little like a much more dangerous villain when you think about it.
It also, like, I mean, it feels very appropriate to the Hand, right? Like, they are ninjas. They should come and go in the shadows. If they even have a figurehead leader, that person should be the last person you suspect, right?
Yeah, it's and Gao has been. She was in season one and season two of Daredevil, and she's you could argue she's the big baddie in the first season of Iron Fist. I mean, she certainly is one of the constellation, and they're all interconnected, and she's the center of it. She was not in Jessica Jones, and I don't recall her being in Luke Cage.
No.
So, but yeah, this is the third series she's shown up in, and like you've pointed out, she does tend to be somebody who is just quietly in the background until she decides that it's time for you to pay attention to her.
And the fact that she is so central to Iron Fist is probably the only reason why I'm eventually going to go back and watch the rest of it.
Oh my gosh.
I would be there for the Madame Gao.
So wait, where did you stop in Iron Fist?
Episode 5. And I understand it does get a little better after that. So
I don't know if that's actually true.
Okay, I can't spoil you then, because the best of Madame Gao is yet to come.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's good to have something to look forward to. And as for Alexandra, I feel like if we're going to be honest here, Sigourney Weaver is not really playing a character the same way David Tennant or especially Vincent D'Onofrio have in the previous Marvel series. Sigourney Weaver is basically playing Sigourney Weaver doing evil stuff in a series of fabulous outfits. And the good thing about that is that she's really good at playing Sigourney Weaver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Patrician Sigourney Weaver. I mean, this is the thing I find kind of interesting about her in both episode one and episode two is she seems to be at a profound remove from the flow and rhythm of human activity and human emotion. Like, this is somebody who, if she's ever had an emotion, has pinned it down with like a big pearl headed pin and stuck it in a bell jar so she could observe it. And, you know, cause she's recounting, oh, Brahms could be petty like that. And she's like lightly bemused, but you never get the sense with her, Tony, I'm going to just start calling it vampire foreshadowing because you put that figure in my head. You never get that sense with her vampire foreshadowing that she's actually felt an authentic emotion anytime in the last couple hundred years. Like, it's mostly been mild amusement or mild irritation, and her mind and her heart are clearly on things that we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Except that's, I sort of agree with that, but her very first scene shows her human and vulnerable, which is something that Ramirez and Petrie learned from Daredevil, as from the first season of Daredevil as well. Mm-hmm. Before you see Wilson Fisk doing anything evil, you see him as a human being.
Yeah.
And so I would argue that, at least the way I read Alexandra, she is feeling a very big emotion throughout the entire series, and that emotion is fear. And she is covering it over, and she's trying to be cool, play it cool, but she is terrified because she is facing her own death for the first time in centuries. Mm-hmm. And everything she does, I believe, is motivated by that.
I'm going to take your insight because I think it's right. I'm going to say, do you think maybe that her fear is blunting her ability to feel or understand anything else?
It's certainly not leading her to make good decisions.
I am curious where they'll go with this character because I haven't seen too much further. Because I had kind of forgotten about the because it's been a couple weeks since I saw it. Her appearance in episode one that was a very different kind of showing that character in a place of vulnerability. And assuming this character is quite ancient, I have a lot of questions about. You know, how do they feel about humanity? How do they feel about their life? They seem to be not feeling great about their potential demise, right? You could imagine some immortal creatures might be bored of their lives and look forward to that. And perhaps she has work left to be done. But the idea of someone who has been around for a very long time and seems to have a great deal of power And that, if that person is afraid, it seems like they are very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
So, which could make for a great foe for the defenders to have to deal with.
Yep. Yep. So speaking of people who are dangerous when they're scared, let's get back to somebody who was, if not exactly an antagonist in season one of Jessica Jones, somebody who certainly didn't make Jessica's life easier. Talking about Jerry Hogarth, who shows up and has what I consider to be one of the more vexing scenes in this episode. And the reason I find it vexing is because in the larger Netflix / MCU continuity, I'm not sure where it places her or how it illuminates or doesn't illuminate her relationships with other characters. Because Jessica goes digging through the archives. She's digging, and then she's getting ready to go make an appointment so she can go back to the historic documents and trace this shell company back from the 1800s to presumably the 1700s and back further from that. And she actually runs into Jerry Hogarth in the archives. And Hogarth tells her, you want to stay away from this. You need to drop this right now for your own safety. Stop digging, walk away from this and leave it alone. So here, and then Hogarth also, we see her in the next scene. We see her pull Foggy aside and hand him Jessica's business card. And she's like, this is somebody who used to work for us. When she gets into trouble, I expect you to be on it. I don't want to know about it. The firm can't be involved, but we're putting your resources to use. So the thing I am still trying to puzzle out here is Hogarth involved with the hand somehow, or does she merely know who they are and she's doing risk management because she thinks that Jessica's a better long-term bet? Why is she trying to protect Jessica? I don't understand what chess game Hogarth is playing here. And I'm willing to hear hypotheses from all sides because the idea of Hogarth gradually being turned into a big bad is not implausible, but we saw enough of her in Jessica Jones to suggest that she's merely somebody who's morally flexible and not necessarily committed to a really firm, you know, immortality at all costs ethos or you know, I'm going to blow up a city because I feel like it ethos or anything like that.
I have a theory if you're interested.
I am interested. This is why I asked.
So I read Jerry Hogarth as someone who is perfectly comfortable with her own sleaziness. She has leaned in and given that sleaziness a great big hug. And she is.
It's called being a lawyer. So.
Yeah, she's not in any way morally conflicted. She is. Yeah. She will look out for number one. If she has room, she will look out for other people as well. I liked her in Iron Fist because it seemed like Danny Rand helped her reconnect with this more innocent person that she used to be, and she liked that.
Yeah.
And have, you know, it gave her the opportunity to be nice without doing any harm to herself. Mm-hmm. And that's what Jerry Hogarth will do. She will be nice to you if it doesn't cost her anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she obviously feels like Jess is a useful asset. She knows that Jess is poking into something that she shouldn't be poking into. Jerry Hogarth, I would guess, knows enough about the hand to know that she doesn't want to know anything else about the hand and that she doesn't want to go digging into it. It would be more too many headaches, too much hassle. Jerry Hogarth just wants to run her own game and make her money and accrue her power and not get people hurt if she can help it. But, you know, if she can't, oh well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious in terms of in Iron Fist, we learn how much the hand has kind of how much influence they have inside Rand Corporation. It raises the question of, are there other large corporations in New York City that are beholden either openly or beholden to people who have been compromised by the hand? And so, you know, is that why things are complicated for Jerry Hogarth?
If only there were some other large, well-known corporation in the Marvel Universe that was based in New York City but no, there are no other billionaires with superpowers in New York City.
You are hitting my pet peeve with the Netflix verse. You are just because Tony Stark in the MCU verse, Tony Stark is treated as the lead ball that distorts the rubber sheet of that universe, right? You know, between his money and his power. And we've had references to Stark Tech throughout these series, plural, and we know that the Battle of New York happened and that people are living in a world where they've made their peace with space aliens and invasions and superpowered people, or if not made their peace, accepted the reality of them for the most part. And like I said, the group of billionaires in the world is still comparatively small, and Danny Rand would have been news. And it's just weird to me that there has been no overture whatsoever from Stark, even covertly, or even like a Kobe Smulders cameo where you see her checking in as like a temp to do intel. Like, there's been nothing like that. When, you know, Tony is such an outsized influence on everything else. Like, I just don't understand how these two New Yorks are expected to exist in our minds, to coexist, to become one. Does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah. I can imagine Tony Stark just going, Danny Rand? Oh, yeah, that guy. Boring. Moving on.
But, you know, shouldn't he have somebody to deal with that? Like, even if he doesn't have to deal with it firsthand? I mean, you know, yeah. It seems like he can delegate that to an intern.
Yeah. I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow does Glee, so there's, like, literally no reason why she can't show up on a Netflix thing where you see her having lunch with Ward. And you find out this is her keeping tabs on Rand Corporation to see if they're moving into Stark territory. Like, you could easily do something like that.
Because they're either not the same New York or, you know, ninjas are everywhere. So.
Well, yeah. There's been a marked lack of ninjas in the MCU movie universe.
Yeah,
so,
they should be every time they like take off from the Avengers Tower, like a ninja should get sucked into the intake of their jets.
Exactly, like the Quinjet has ninjas hanging off of it, and like you see Hawkeye do a barrel roll. Ah, we're infested with ninjas again.
Hawkeye tries to make an incredible trick shot. You know, damn it, hit a ninja again. Yeah. Those guys are everywhere.
So it's like, Hawkeye, why can't you just use ninjas as your arrows? Or they're you're onto something.
Wouldn't that make him Ronin then? Sorry, comic book nerd joke.
Well, no. Reference acknowledged. Reference acknowledged, and possibly, God help us, maybe that's what's coming in Infinity War, because he did break out with everybody else. He can't grow a beard. Steve's already got that market. Maybe he just puts on the ninja outfit. There, that's how we've solved the ninja problem, guys. Congratulations. But the Hogarth thing kind of bugged me just because I can't figure out what her motivations are. And I'm like, are they sinister? Are they self-centered? Are they both? Are they neither? I appreciate us trying to bottom that out together. And let's see what else was there. We've talked about, Nathan, you mentioned that Matt's relationship to... his alter ego is admittedly tortured in this episode. And
yeah, I love that first scene. I wanted to say S.J. Clarkson directs the hell out of this episode. She directs this episode as if her life depended on it.
Mm-hmm.
And There's I love the l- first lot scene
of camera,
in particular.
A lot of camera spins in this one.
Yeah.
True, but I would argue they're motivated. Like, for example, she does Dutch angles in a lot of scenes, and a lot of times directors, Kenneth Branagh, use Dutch angles as a lazy shorthand for comic books. But Clarkson uses them to kind of capture the impatience that we're all feeling. We're all kind of leaning forward, wanting these characters to intersect. And she uses the Dutch angles to kind of create that energy and momentum. And in the opening scene with Matt, you know, so an earthquake's just hit Manhattan and Matt is up on his roof and they don't stage it like, you know, here's the superhero coming out to save the day. It's like Matt has just turned into the Wolfman. He's like cocking his head animalistically, bounding off across the rooftops.
And he's overwhelmed by senses. Like, that's what I loved about the camera work there, too, is it mimics his confusion as he tries to sort through all the data and figure out what's relevant.
Exactly. And the whole thing is bathed in convenient red neon light, part of one more part of the series' amazing use of color throughout.
Yeah. So, I really love the use of the color and how you can kind of tell what sequence you're in based on whether it reads as red, blue, green, or gold. I just... it's such a fun series to look at.
It is. And it's a fun series to listen to. There's a scene later on with where Matt and Jess take turns tailing each other. I'm getting ahead of myself. That's the next episode. Never mind. Shutting up now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's wait for till episode 3 on that one. And let's see if we have anything to wrap up. We've gone about 25 minutes to here talking about episode 2. And I feel like we've hit a lot of the points. We've hit the fact that Jessica Jones is occasionally good at her job. We have hit the fact that Alexandra is intriguing and her fear seems to be driving the bus on her grand scheme. We've talked about how Madame Gao is hiding in plain sight. We know that Danny and Luke have battled each other, and that was kind of fun, mostly because I would say a significant percentage of viewers wanted to see Luke Cage beat up Danny Rand.
And I love the way Luke Cage fights. I love it's character defined through action. He is annoyed that all these little people keep hitting him. He doesn't put any effort or technique into fighting. He's just, ugh. And then he's tossing people through walls because it is the easiest, most convenient thing for him to do. And I I love that that defines him, especially, and it's a great contrast to Danny's fluid, florid kung fu movements, which look even more puny and ridiculous when he's applying them to a guy who will not be moved.
Yes. Well, the thing that I find interesting is, like you said, Luke fights like his character. He's practical. He's focused on results. And he, you know, again, he's thinking two or three steps ahead. And those two or three steps are, how do I just get this done so I can move on to what I really want to do? Like, fights for him are inconvenient. Whereas for Danny, there's always an element of performance.
Well, yeah, he's got something to prove, so he's always going to show off because he has to show everyone, oh, I'm the Immortal Iron Fist.
Well, what I was going to say is, what I wonder is if that's actually part of the Crane Mother training, because the culture in Iron Fist was a whole lot of you had these tests and you learned these skills and you had all these trials and you had these rituals and this is the tradition, and it seems like when Danny is fighting, he's kind of reflecting the cultural he's reflecting the cultural education he got there as well. And one of the things that has struck me about Danny in this episode, and this is actually kind of a holdover from Iron Fist too, and my hope is that we get to this in the second season of Iron Fist, is that Danny may be in New York, but mentally and emotionally he's still a little boy in a mysterious monastery up in the hills. Like, that is where his mind is. That is his frame of reference. He has not yet understood that, like, he's actually a grown man who chose to go someplace else, and he's going to have to understand how the people who live here, what their frames of reference are, and his fighting reflects that.
Yeah, he's still such a childish character in a lot of really frustrating ways, because you'd think that even being in a mystical city, he would have grown up, he would have matured, but he still acts like the kid he was when he crash landed in Kunlun.
Yeah, because I think for him and a lot of the people in the Crane Mother, I keep wanting to say convent, and that is absolutely not the right word, because a bunch of dude monks would disagree. It's not a convent. but I think maybe in the monastery, the idea of mastering different levels of kung fu was supposed to reflect some sort of inner maturity or emotional maturity, and they weren't paying careful enough attention to people's actual psychological development. And so when they're like, oh yeah, you're now the dragon protector of Kunlun, like, that's great that Danny can do kung fu and punch a dragon and take its heart and all of that, but it's not like it gave him the emotional maturity or intellectual capacity to adapt his skills and his outlook to places other than a monastery. Mm-hmm. So
I love how spectacularly useless Danny is throughout this entire episode. He spends most of his time either tagging along after Colleen, who is doing real detective work, meditating or sleeping. He is always focused only on himself and his own troubles. He's not thinking about anyone else. And Colleen is the baddest. She's the one who looks up the clues, looks up the ninja sword, tracks down the place, drags Danny along to the place. And I also wanted to point out, I love the camera work in that scene when they find the sword shop full of dead good guy ninjas. S.J. Clarkson moves the camera in a beautiful fluid long take through that space, and she uses the big open space to create multiple framings, focusing on different aspects of this one larger scene and ending on Danny realizing that a scroll on the wall depicts Kunlun. I don't know how he'd know it was Kunlun, and maybe that building is like Kunlun's equivalent of the Statue of Liberty or something.
Yeah, but it's an important landmark. So
because I was like, it's like Danny, I've seen art like that on in countless sushi shops, and he's like, no, it's Kunlun, and you're like, oh, he's like, why do they have a then he's like in a snit, well, why do they have a picture of Kunlun? And I'm like, it's a free world, Danny, people can take pictures of things. Jesus.
Now I want to see Danny like walking into a random sushi restaurant and being like, oh my god, they've got a picture of Kunlun in every Chinese or sushi restaurant. He's just like, how do they have a picture of Kunlun? Danny, it's not a picture of Kunlun.
Like, Colleen gets really mad at him and just starts messing with his head that way, taking him to different places.
Colleen Wing puts up with, they have no chemistry together. It's like she's taking pity on him more than anything
else. I mean, he does own her building at this point, so
yeah,
it's complicated. Yeah,
she's supposed to be in love with him and vice versa, and they've got no spark.
Not really, no.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, to be fair, they've pretty much had just each other for company for the last year while they bopped around the globe. So maybe they're a little sick of each other, too. Like, for all you know, most of the defenders is all of them. Oh, thank God I have someone else to talk to, because this person, I have run out of doing airplane crossword puzzles with them and I'm just done. But in this episode, we find out that there's a bunch of good ninjas who got killed. We also see that Alexandra happens to have tied up Stick and clearly wants something from him. And Stick, of course, has told her to pound sand, and she doesn't take that well. You know where Stick is. Matt is sure to follow. So there we're with that. And that was pretty much it for episode two. It was a little bit more movie. You know, there was some fan service.
I was surprised to see Stick. I guess I was not expecting to see Stick in the Defenders. So I started like ticking through my list of all the secondary Marvel series characters. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, I guess we've checked in on a lot of them. I think probably the only one that, and maybe he just doesn't appear in the Defenders at all, which I'm fine with, would be Frank Castle. But it seems like almost everybody else gets at least a scene in the first two episodes.
And real quick, I love Trish Walker's brief scene. It's unfortunate that it never really goes anywhere. It's just disconnected, but it's a great little scene of kind of that conspiracy theory frisson, where she's talking about the earthquake and a seismologist calls in and says, wait a minute, that wasn't a naturally occurring earthquake. That was only 300 feet deep. Click. Yep. And then all of a sudden the higher ups have mysteriously told Trish, there's, you know, don't talk about this anymore. And Trish basically goes, huh, that's weird. Okay, on with my life.
Like, I can't believe she didn't just text Jessica up. But then again, maybe she's like, no, this is the last thing that my crazy obsessive friend needs. Being Jessica Jones' friend seems exhausting because you're constantly second guessing yourself as to what will make your friend healthier versus what will drive her further into a bottle.
Well, yeah, but Trish is more of a sister to Jess than anything. Yeah. So, you know, she's that extra bond, I think, is going to keep her as Jess's friend, even no matter how exasperating Jess gets.
No, but I think what I'm trying to say is, if you're Trish, you're probably weighing, would information about a possible conspiracy be something that I think would give Jessica a reason to get out of bed and maybe not put whiskey in her coffee? Or would it just make her crazier and more depressed? How do I play this? True. You know, what do I tell her? When do I tell her? Because there's a little bit of that, too.
I mean, you could argue that pretty much anything would drive Jessica Jones to drink. Look, here's a picture of a cute dog. Drink.
It's not drive. It's a short walk.
No. Yeah. I would assume that when the liquor drone delivery service launches, Jessica Jones will be like, okay, at last, I never need to leave this place again. Here we go. So I want to wrap up this episode because we've done about 35 minutes on the Defenders, and I think we've touched on all the major points. We've talked about, I wouldn't call it Danny Rand problem, but it's certainly a Danny Rand condition, which is that you've got this man-child running around in the same series that contains Luke Cage, who is responsibility personified, Jessica Jones, who is adult neuroses and hangups personified, and Matt Murdock, who still is trying to figure out what he wants to be when he grows up.
And Matt, I think is guilt and responsibility, and especially in this episode, addiction. They lean really hard on the addiction metaphor in this episode, especially in his scene with Foggy.
Yeah, so I actually have to point out something, and this is a little bit of a nitpick, is Foggy and Karen both treat the Daredevil like this character flaw he needs to get over. And I keep wondering, have they successfully made the case that people are right to be repelled by these seemingly contradictory sides to Matt's personality? Or is this just something which is supposed to heighten the dramatic stakes and make it seem like Matt has to make a choice, to either, you know, be a naturally gifted fighter who dispenses justice with his fists, or, you know, be a lawyer who has friends and loved ones?
Well, I mean, obviously we're all rooting for him to be Daredevil because it's more fun than watching The Adventures of Matt Murdock, lawyer, but you can make a good case that in the world they're behaving rationally. If you had a dear, dear friend who liked to dress up in sweatpants and go out at night and beat people bloody and came home, you know, beat to hell on a regular basis, was always flaking on you whenever you needed them, was hurting your professional relationships and your own career, and was endangering the very thing that he does for a living with all of his night activities, you would want him to stop too. It's a perfectly rational feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's the gift of this series that they actually make it look like Foggy and Karen are the ones being slightly unreasonable. So this is Nathan's entire monologue, which is entirely on point, was like one of the greatest things about Daredevil season two, which is that a lot of the season sets it up as Matt is being insanely selfish and Matt is being insanely short-sighted and he's high in his own self-righteousness and isn't capable of seeing a bigger moral picture. And you get a whole lot of that, like arcing all the way through the series. And they do a brilliant feint when they suggest that, oh, it's because Elektra turns his head and he's more of a jerk when he's around Elektra. And then you find out, no, actually, this is pretty much Matt. This is Matt to the core. You know, Elektra has her own thing going on.
And that ties beautifully into the Catholicism that is such a big part of Matt's character. You know, a lot of Catholicism is acknowledging that we live in a fallen world, that the world is imperfect, that we cannot help but sin. And that all we can do is fumble our way through this fallen world, sinning all over the place, and then ask forgiveness. And that literally
owning our sins and trying not to repeat them is a big part of it too. I mean, that's the whole point to the ritual of confession.
True.
The sacrament of confession, I should say. Oh, once upon a time. The sacrament of confession is you're supposed to acknowledge your sins and, you know, you do your penance, and they do say, go forth and sin no more. And while that's impossible, a lot of priests will also be like, you know, the point is not to keep repeatedly doing something you know it's wrong. The point is to prayerfully reflect on why you did it, acknowledge the motivations, and then consciously act against those motivations in the future.
And the problem with Matt, yeah, and probably part of mm-hmm. the reason why he dresses like the devil, is that mm-hmm. like the devil, you know, he feels he has no choice. The devil never really had a choice. His role was preordained by God. You know, he was always going to betray God. He was always going to fall because that's what God wanted him to do. And I think Matt feels like he has no choice. He has this calling. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of what's great about the character is that you're never sure, is it a righteous calling or does he just really need to beat the crap out of criminals because he's angry inside? But
Would he be beating the crap out of somebody else if he didn't have the moral compass he has?
Exactly. And so he is damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. And I love that the way they, mm-hmm. they revisit that push-pull in this series. He is trying so hard to be a lawyer, but he has to be Daredevil. It's the mm-hmm. push and pull between what you want to be and what you have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So on that note, what we're going to do is wrap up DefendoCast for Defenders Season 1, Episode 2, and breaking it down and giving us all of the character explanation that we need. We had Nathan Alderman with us.
Thank you very much for letting me be the annoying Iron Fist to your far more competent heroes.
Not at all. We wouldn't call you Iron Fist. I think you're Colleen Wing. And
I will take that. That's a compliment.
Exactly. And here to keep us honest so we don't talk about the series as a whole, because he's watching it like a sane person and not like a lunatic who binges, is Tony Sindelar.
I'm just a different type of lunatic. Goodbye, nerds.
Goodbye, nerds. All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.